Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There is a wonderful exhibition. There's always a wonderful exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum, but right now it's a celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Calatrava design, Santiago Calatrava Designed Museum, which is absolutely gorgeous, and it has received attention from all over the world. It is a space, those of you who have been there know that when you walk in there, you go there to get enlightened and to feel good and to look at the art, but also just to stand inside this building is a treat. As far as I'm concerned, it's the most beautiful place, certainly in the city of Milwaukee. And starting in September and very much this month and on into January, the Milwaukee Art Museum is celebrating the 10th anniversary of this building. The exhibit is Building a Masterpiece, Santiago Calatrava and the Milwaukee Art Museum. And this hour of the program, we're going to be talking about how he was chosen, the whole process of how that was built, because it's not only beautiful, a work of art, it's also a magnificent work of architecture. So we're going to hear about the whole process. And welcome phone calls. I know there are people listening all over the state who love this building, and you want to know how it was constructed and designed and all of that. We're delighted to do this program this hour. The director of the Milwaukee Art Museum, Daniel Keegan, is joining us in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Daniel, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Brady Roberts, who's been with us before, chief curator of the Milwaukee Art Museum, is also with us. Brady knows everything about architecture as well. Are you an architect?
I am not an architect, but I've worked on architecture projects throughout my career, just coincidentally, so I've been very interested in architecture.
Yeah. Tell me how this whole process started. When did somebody decide the museum needs Santiago Calatrava to come and design a new museum?
A long time ago. You'd have to go back. It might be interesting, too, to talk this hour about the history of the museum. You know, in 2013,
sure,
we will celebrate the 125th anniversary of the Milwaukee Art Museum.
Wow.
And the point here is, you know, museums are dynamic institutions, and they change and grow over time. So the story of the Quadracci Pavilion, as it's named, designed by Santiago Calatrava, is really the story of a museum's growth. And so, you know, we could look to Frederick Layton back in 1888 giving his collection to the city and the region of Milwaukee for its citizens to enjoy, and that resulting in a building downtown, which resulted in a new building at the lakefront in the 1950s designed by Eero Saarinen, and then a Kaler addition in the 70s, and then discussion of, well, how do we grow from here? And, you know, that's where Brady can pick up the pieces here, because as the curator of this exhibition, he knows better than anyone that, you know, at some point in time there was this idea to do an addition.
Like, it's
a wild
idea, and some of them are wonderful.
So this is in the early 1990s, where the ideas were really formalized that the museum needed more space, particularly for special exhibitions, but also they had the goal of making an architectural statement, a world-class architectural statement. Mm. So the leadership of the museum at the time initiated an international architecture search, and they had over 70 architects submit proposals initially. And interestingly, Calatrava was not among those. But the director at the time, Russell Bowman, read about his work in a magazine and said, you know, we really need to include this architect. So he came in later, and then at the end of 1994, Calatrava won the design competition.
But, you know, typically these ideas start very modestly. This is not unusual. Everyone has perhaps heard the story about the art museum's plan to do an addition and how it grew and grew and got more and more expensive and all of that great stuff that happens. It's actually fairly typical. Because when the ideas are first tossed out, it could be led by a director, co-directors in this case, Chris Goldsmith and Russell Bowman, or it could be driven by the board or an obvious need that everyone recognizes. Hey, we're out of space. And so the first question, of course, is, well, what does this mean for us? What's the scope of the project? What should this be? What I think distinguishes the art museum in this case is they, as Brady just mentioned, the leadership in the museum had this sense that the museum needed a grander front door, a stronger statement around the architecture.
It certainly got it. And then some, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then some. So you invited him to come. Did he come to Milwaukee and look at it, and then he decided sort of reluctantly, or was he willing to?
No, this was actually, at the time, it was a sort of a critical juncture for Calatrava because he was well-known in Europe, building principally in Spain and also in France. He had built a rather wonderful but minor building in Canada and had no buildings in the United States. So at the time, he was 44 years old, and he was hungry to make his mark outside of Europe. And this was the project, in fact, that would launch him and make him an internationally known architect. And the leaders of the board at the time really wanted an architect who was not known in the United States but would be important. I mean, they were viewing him like an important artist. And they made a very enlightened decision, and they gave him the freedom to design a brilliant building and gave him the resources to execute that.
I think I read that you said that he always was taking notes. He travels with a notebook. So when he came here, was he sketching?
He's visual, so he always has a pad of paper with him, and when he's talking architecture, he's doing renderings, and they might be in charcoal. Frequently, they're done in watercolor. I even heard the story of how Calatrava was visiting with a donor at their house, and he asked for a cup of coffee, and he pulled a watercolor brush out of his pocket, and he painted a little sketch in coffee on a napkin. And it, you know, absolutely delighted the patron. But he's such a visual person. He's always rendering things. And the other thing that he does, this is the sort of yin and yang of Calatrava. He was trained as an engineer as well as an architect. So he can sit down and do engineering calculations on the spot. In fact, he did that frequently during the construction process of the building.
Because you look at the building and you think, how did anybody know that this could conceivably be built? It looks like it would be impossible to build it.
Well, that's the interesting mix of Santiago Calatrava's genius. As Brady mentioned, trained as an engineer, obviously studied as an architect, but also an artist. So he's carrying with him in his brain these three unique components, the ability to think outside the box like an artist, the ability to work like an architect who has to be concerned about program, you know, architects speak for how's the building going to be used, what's the experience inside, and then understanding the engineering principles so that his crazy, wacky artist part can actually be put into real-life form. And, you know, it's great to start with the napkin doodle, and there's lots of evidence that architects like to work in this free-form way. But oftentimes they'll hand that doodle off to someone else to figure it out. In this case, you have the architect who's starting with the doodle, running the program in his mind, and then doing the calculations. That's genius.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting thing that many architects will design stunning buildings that can't be built. And they'll take that design to an engineer who will tell them why it can't be built. And that's where the compromise starts. So with Calatrava, the aesthetics and the engineering are all part of the same package.
So did he have a lot of initial designs, or was this the one that we see now?
It evolved. And actually, that's the thing that you see in the exhibition, which is in two parts. The watercolor show is in the cost gallery, and those are the earliest designs. And you'll see that in 1994, he won the commission in December of 1994. So he had some early ideas already, and you see those, but you see it's just basically a vocabulary. He hadn't figured out many things that we take for granted today. For instance, one of the challenges thrown out to all of the 70 architects who participated in the design competition was to link downtown with the lakefront. And Calatrava did that brilliantly. As a bridge builder, he literally bridged downtown with the lakefront. Nobody else figured out how to do that, because of the great height difference between downtown and the lower elevation of the lakefront. So just that beautiful axial arrangement with Wisconsin Avenue across the Ryman Bridge into Quadracci Pavilion and right to Lake Michigan, it seems so perfect and effortless that we just take it for granted. Well, he had to think of that,
right,
and nobody else
right.
did. So, you know, it's things like that that really distinguish him and made the building incredible.
Yeah. Tell me what it's like. Every time I go, and now we know people because of the interviews we've done, but every time I go there, I say to the people who are there, you must just love to be able to stand in certain parts of this museum and refresh yourself during a day. It's such a gorgeous place. to be? Is it, do you feel, I know work is work, but it must be a privilege to both of you to work in this kind of atmosphere, isn't it?
It's quite a privilege. It's quite an honor. And, you know, I've been at the museum now a little over 3.5 years. I was familiar with the project from its early days. But to be there every day, I can tell you this, there are no bad views of that building, inside or out. It's absolutely stunning. It's ever-changing. It is such an organic building. The light changes during the seasons, the angles change depending on where you're standing. And most importantly, Kathleen, from a visitor standpoint, I see every day people from literally all over the world who just marvel at that building. That doesn't mean that everyone loves it.
Really? Not everybody loves it? It's had its critics. Oh, my.
But you know, people do recognize that it is one of the most recognizable buildings in the world now. It's been listed in over 600 publications worldwide. So it's fascinating every day.
And you see it in television commercials and movies.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that the building achieved international recognition as soon as the designs were released in 1997. There was international interest right off the bat. When the building was under construction, it was very interesting looking from a sculptural standpoint. So there continued to be interest during construction. Then it opened, and it's unlike any other building in the world. And now at age 10, as you say, recently it was just voted the sexiest building in the world. Victoria's Secret shot an ad there. Transformers featured it in their movie. American Idol shot there. So it's like, you know, Hollywood has discovered our building. So the reputation is growing. And one of the nice things that we get to do is take people on tours through the building. And it's a building that's on people's bucket list. So we have major collectors from all over coming and visiting for the first time. And they're so overwhelmed when they see the building in person. I mean, it photographs well, but it's not the experience of being in the building. As you say, it's changing constantly with the light changing the different seasons. So it's just a beautiful experience.
Well, you were taking a chance on somebody who was well-known in Europe, but certainly not in America. What you said caught my ear when you said not everybody liked it. Was there controversy about this design and about Calatrava back in the early 90s, or did people embrace it fully?
It's my understanding there was a lot of discussion and there were a lot of opinions, but the building committee at the time traveled to visit the existing buildings of the architects, which is a smart thing to do. And they took a trip to Lyon in France and visited Calatrava's train station and airport there, which is an absolutely stunning building. And I think at that point, everyone was convinced that this was the right architect. And then the other key thing that happened, and you'll see this in the exhibition, there's a model that was built in 1996. And that's the year that Calatrava invented Burke Brisolet, the movable wings of the building. So this model has movable wings, and it has most of the basic elements of the building articulated. It's a stunning model. Everyone knew at that time that's the building they had to have.
The building is so out of the box that it's a challenge when people are considering, again, thinking about it from a cost standpoint, thinking about it from a funding sort of design idea use standpoint. It is so out of the box. There are no right angles in this building. It is one of those moments in which you can imagine the leadership back in the 90s looking at this and at once saying, holy cow, this is fantastic, wonderful, and holy cow, what are we thinking?
Right.
And, you know, I've heard many stories. Donald Baumgartner, for example, who still chairs our facilities committee, chaired the building committee back then. And, you know, he said there was this point at which everyone knows that this is brilliant, it's genius, and they've got to do it, yet they're also looking around at each other going, oh, my.
But, you know, it was the right group of people, and the one of the other key people, Jack Pelisak, was just so in love with the project. He was a great fundraiser, cheerleader, promoter of the project, and with Donald and Betty and Harry Quadracci and the Lubars and the Seeligs, all the people that got behind the museum, it was the right group of people to do this privately funded, extraordinary building.
Well, and it's such a risk for Milwaukee because we're not a real flashy city. I love the city we work. Everybody, you know, it's solid. The communities are, we've got our own set of problems. But there's something just very Midwestern about this city. And then you've got the Calatrava, and it's like different than anything that we have in this city. And it must have been risky for some people to say, let's put this gorgeous, inventive, work of art right in the prime real estate of the whole city on the gorgeous lakefront and make something that's unlike anything that we have?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. One is it is both an incredible signifier of opportunity ahead. It's a city willing to look forward. But also I think it was possible because in spite of that Midwestern conservatism, the history of Milwaukee is an interesting one. It was built on entrepreneurship, free thinkers, creative energy that really was also out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain otherwise this incredible manufacturing base, the creative sort of craftsman artisan base that goes all the way back to the 19th century and people who arrived in Milwaukee with a nickel in their pocket and figured out how to create some of the best corporations in America here? I mean, that's an interesting creative spirit that perhaps we had lost track of here in Milwaukee. And I think the Quadracci Pavilion sent that signal again to a lot of folks, hey, wait a minute, this is a great place, and look where we're headed. Mm-hmm. Look what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also become, you know, one of the most revered symbols of the community. Visit Milwaukee uses it as its principal logo. The newscasts are oftentimes done in front of the museum. So I think we see it as that symbol of a forward-moving city.
Yes. Is Calatrava a sailor?
You know, I don't know that he's a sailor, but as an architect, he's always drawing his cues from the site. So when he started working on the Milwaukee project, obviously the maritime setting was a strong influence. And you see this again in the watercolors. There are these enormous scrolls that he painted. He would just take these huge sheets of white paper and he'd be talking about the building and doing watercolors, and you see birds and sails and then the forms of what would be the Burke Brisolet. So all of this is coming together in his mind. And, of course, coming from Spain, he's, you know, surrounded by water. So, you know, it's just something that was sort of in his subconscious. And you see this almost stream of consciousness evolution of the design in the watercolor part of the show.
And those elements are within his repertoire. So he has a vocabulary. And if you look at his other building designs, even some of his earliest buildings, you do see the engineer part. You see the skeletal elements that come through in the addition at the Art Museum as well. So it's a vocabulary that he carries forward, but it's also something that he's experimenting with and pushing to the next level each time he's doing a project. And I think that this project is special because it has the moving element of the Burke Brisolet.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things that he recognized early on once he got on to the idea. And Brady, maybe you can talk to that evolution, because as I looked at these drawings, there's a moment at which it starts to appear. And so at some point in his process, he had the notion that this is both bridge-like, it's sunshield, it's dynamic, it's bird-like, and so all of these parts seem to kind of come together at some point in this process. I don't know when. Maybe you could...
Yeah, it happened in 1996, but it's interesting what Dan's saying. It goes all the way back to Calatrava's graduate training. So when he was getting his PhD in engineering, he wrote his dissertation on the foldability of space frames, which was a way of developing an architectural vocabulary that was organic and moving, but also structural. And that's the essence of our building. It's kinetic and organic, but structurally sound. So he had kinetic elements in some of his buildings in Europe, but the early designs of our building are static. And then there is this moment when the light bulb goes off, and you can see all the ingredients coming together in the watercolors, and then in 1996 he has the breakthrough, and the wings and the sail and the Brisolet all become one.
Do you know about that breakthrough? Was it a momentary breakthrough?
I don't know when it occurred, but you can see it in the watercolors, and the models are being developed concurrently, and it's very interesting. The first model looks like an abstract sculpture, and Calatrava is a sculptor, but the first model also shows the counterbalance system, which is the essence of the engineering of our building, where you have hundreds of tons of weight going down the Burke Brisolet, and then hundreds of tons of the Quadracci Pavilion. All that weight is pulled by cables to the center of the building. You see the suspension cables of the bridge. What you don't see are the 100 cables that hold up the cantilever of the Quadracci Pavilion, and all of that tonnage comes together in the center. So in his earliest abstract form, the engineering was already at the core of it.
Was it really hard to build?
It was. You know, the building, you have to think of it as being like a handmade sculpture. And for the builders, it was unlike any other project they had ever worked on or ever will work on. And Calatrava was very smart. Once the contracting team was put together, he invited them to Spain for 11 days. And he showed them his architecture and talked to them about how different this was going to be. And he showed them the degree of finish of his buildings, which are exquisite. They're sculptures. And he was also building the team. And everyone that I talked to that worked on the project and spent time with Calatrava absolutely loves him. He's an inspirational person. And during construction, it was so challenging because nobody knew how to build the things they had to build. He would come at least once a month, and he would explain to them how they could build things. And he has a gift for taking very complicated ideas and making them simple. And he also cared about people. He cared about everyone who was on the team. So it was really an extraordinary experience for those people who were involved.
There are a lot of unsung heroes on this project, starting with the architect of record, the local architects who had to translate those wild ideas, and that's Kaler Slater. You know, Calatrava's drawings would be handed over to them, and they'd have to figure out how to go through all of those fine drawings and details to make it work, to prove literally that it would work, prove with the structural engineers, etc. Then there's the local craftsmen who had to build it. C.G. Schmidt was the local contractor who had to figure out how to build the forms. I tell people often when they're in the building to imagine no glass in this building. Glass is not structural. And so you have to stand in the building or outside and take away all of the glass, and you realize how it is a very complex knitting together of steel-reinforced concrete forms. It's a holy cow moment when you do that, because then you realize how many of these elements are cantilevering, what the counterbalances are, and how that skeleton, if you will, is literally the heart of this beautiful building.
We're going to take phone calls for both of you. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Building a Masterpiece, Santiago Calatrava and the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's at the museum, the exhibit now, and it runs through January 1st. We also have a couple pairs of tickets. I'd be particularly interested in getting somebody to Milwaukee to see this who's never seen the Calatrava before from, I don't care if you're from Iowa, this isn't necessarily the case, but it'd be nice to have somebody come to the city from someplace far, far away to see this beauty, this great beauty. But we're going to put this on Facebook. So what you need to do is this. You go to our Facebook page and you reply to the thread about the Milwaukee Art Museum for a chance to get a pair of free passes, good until January 1st of 2012. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And go there, and I hope you win. If not, come and see the Calatrava. This is a perfect time to, many of you have been here many times before, but to celebrate the 10th anniversary. Our guests in our downtown Milwaukee studios, Daniel Keegan, director of the Milwaukee Art Museum, Brady Roberts is the chief curator. 800-486-8655 is the number, and the email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now. Let's start with Bob in Washington Island. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning. A beautiful subject you're talking about. I've only seen pictures of it.
Oh, Bob, you got to come and see it.
I plan to.
All right.
I like architecture, and I like Frank Lloyd Wright, but I don't think Wright ever built a building that didn't have a roof that leaked. And genius has a way of sometimes doing things like that. How is the maintenance on this building, and how sustainable do you think it's going to be?
Well, this has been one of the real wonderful surprises about this unique building, Bob. And to your point, unique architecture often presents its challenges. because no one really quite knows how it will perform. The Quadracci Pavilion has performed magnificently for 10 years. We also go through a very strict regimen of maintaining various moving components of this building. Most recently, of course, we're in the process of replacing a hydraulic cylinder for the Burke Breeze Soleil. But that's 10 years later, 22 cylinders functioning every day, opening and closing and staying open under pressure. And, you know, we've just been amazed at the quality of the construction overall throughout this building. You know, it's a building, it's a sculpture. Oh, and by the way, it moves. So it's at once complex, but it's also been an amazing performing building for us.
You want to add to that, Brady? Do you anticipate certain structural problems down the road or not?
No, as Dan said, I mean, it's an amazing, well-crafted building, and it's a Milwaukee story with our tradition of precision craftsmanship. It's such a carefully constructed building. The engineering is solid. It's just incredibly well made, and it's enduring quite well. Because it's pristine white, I mean, there's certain cosmetic maintenance that needs to be done on a regular basis, but structurally it's a very sound building. I will add, since we did a Frank Lloyd Wright show earlier this year, that Frank Lloyd Wright always maintained that the leaks were the fault of the contractors.
Is that true?
I don't know, but that's what he maintained.
As well he should have. Thanks, Bob, for the call. Paul in Washington County, hi.
Hi, good morning. I agree that it's a beautiful, magnificent, huge sculpture, but that's the point. This architect with a strong personality and engineering background, but because of his personality, he sold the committee on building a monumental sculpture rather than an art museum. If you compare that with the Kansas City Art Museum, the amount of square footage that the Kansas City Art Museum has compared to this thing is just an enormous difference. And the cost, you know, this thing costs $200 million, approaching $200 million. Compare the square footage it has, the amount of available wall space, and plus it's in conflict with the adjacent architecture of the original art museum. I think it conflicts because of the nature of this architecture compared to the other one.
Do you like the way it looks, Paul?
Also, the footbridge, I mean, I think the footbridge is a maintenance problem right now, and that's going to, if you take a look at it, I've been on it, and it's going to require ongoing maintenance, and you're going to have to budget for it.
All right. And do you like the design of it, though? Do you think it's aesthetically beautiful?
Aesthetically beautiful, but it's a huge, we paid for a huge sculpture. We didn't, the intent was to have an art museum that had a lot of expansion capability, and we didn't achieve that.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Well, just a couple of observations on that. Actually, the art part of the building functions extremely well. Baker Rowland Gallery's 10,000 square foot column-free space. It's incredibly flexible. There's also the Lubar Auditorium, the parking garage, the cafe. These were all the functional elements that were part of the program that are well achieved. And then the other goal, of course, was to have a world-class architectural statement. And when you walk into Quadracci Pavilion, it's unlike any other building in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'd say he actually achieved everything that was put in front of him by the committee. And how it does work well with the existing Saarinen and Kaler buildings is that we have over 100,000 square feet of gallery space in the first two buildings. So now we have everything that we need in terms of square footage with the three buildings. In terms of the cost, actually, our building costs about $1,000 a square foot, which by today's standards is quite modest. So the Stephen Hole building at the Nelson Atkins Museum that the caller mentioned, I believe, costs more than that. The Renzo Piano edition of the Art Institute of Chicago was probably more than twice that per square foot. Any Frank Gehry building, any Daniel Libeskind building is going to be beyond $1,000 a square foot. So it's not out of line with museum architecture.
What about the footbridge? Does it have problems, he said?
No, the footbridge, actually, we do, first of all, have a very rigorous schedule of maintenance for the entire facility. It's important that we know what's coming. It's important to know what needs to be redone periodically, whether that's grout in the stone or whatever. We recently did a tune-up to the bridge itself. It's inspected every year. so that we know that structurally there are no changes or adjustments that need to be made. As Brady mentioned earlier, it is suspended by cable, so it too is a dynamic element. But there are no surprises there, and any construction or repairs are part of the process of maintaining any quality building. Mm-hmm. Deferred maintenance is the kiss of death for buildings. And this being a world-class piece of architecture that needs to last for generations, we have it on an even more strict schedule for keeping it in great shape. I would also add that one of the incredible things about this building, since the caller mentioned the price, it was not $200 million, it was $120 million. All of that was done with private funding, and the building is paid for. We're completely debt-free. So it's an interesting moment for us as we move forward into this anniversary cycle.
Some emails have come in. Robin in Shorewood, I love, capital letters, the Calatrava edition, particularly, I'm with her on this, the glass elevator and the garage. The garage is a work of art.
It is. It's interesting. When Calatrava came to Milwaukee while he was designing the building, he went around the state and he looked at Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture. And one of the places he went was S.C. Johnson corporate headquarters, which is a great cathedral-like space. Wright, of course, was very influenced by the site of his architecture. And when you go to that building, if you see the original parking garage, it repeats the architectural motifs of the main building. And that inspired Calatrava to design our building, which has the beautiful ribs that you see in the main level of Quadracci Pavilion.
And that's actually a great tour to take, is to go down to Racine and go to the S.C. Johnson headquarters and their new welcome center, designed by another world-class architect, Sir Norman Foster. But Brady's right on. You can't go into that parking structure at S.C. Johnson and then into the main hall and not think, wow, Santiago Calatrava made that visit.
Mm-hmm. Was he a Wright fan for years?
Absolutely. He loved Wright's idea of organic architecture in responding to the site. And you see those principles in his building. He has his own style, his own vocabulary that he arrived at independently. But he was a great admirer of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Mm-hmm. It's hard not to. He really has a sense of the water, I think, too, and the sailboats. There's nothing, I love to sail, I haven't for a few years, but there's nothing like standing in that pavilion looking at the boats that are going by, because first you feel like you're on one, and you just know that he took that boat somehow and it entered his hands and his mind and he brought it into the pavilion.
It's beautiful. It's the prow of the ship, and when you go outside and you look at that lakefront of the Quadracci Pavilion, you see that it's cantilevered, so it's about 60 feet that's not suspended by columns, and that gives you that sensation of projecting out over over the water, and it's quite beautiful.
It is quite beautiful. Tom in Stoddard. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Yes, I was interested in the, I was very impressed with the building, but when I was looking at closely at the building, I was noticing all these hairline cracks in the cement, which is overlaid on the, over the steel. And I'm wondering about long-term problems with corrosion of the steel, possibly falling away also of the cement off of the steel structure.
Yeah, we recently had all of that looked at, and those come up from time to time. It's kind of the nature of the beast of cast concrete and reinforced steel. One of the nice things about this building is that it is painted white, so it's very easy to touch up and, most importantly, to seal those hairline cracks. If you think about bridge structures and exposed concrete buildings, it's one of the major challenges with concrete, and especially in a severe climate like we have in Wisconsin, where moisture penetration and then freeze-thawing expansion can deteriorate concrete structures quite rapidly. Look at the Hone Bridge and the troubles with that, which is, again, those kinds of things are anticipated and expected. They're part of the cost of having a building. The Quadracci Pavilion is unique in that it's painted white, and that surface can be sealed and protected on a regular basis. So it's part of the routine maintenance. The structural engineers and analysis that we go through every year when we have the building inspected say that it's no big deal. It's part of what you get with concrete, those surface hairline cracks. And because the building's painted white, those little hairline cracks oftentimes will collect dust and dirt, and so that's what the caller is actually seeing when they see those. It's touched up every year or so periodically.
Thanks, Tom. Andy in Milwaukee. Hi, Andy.
Hi. My question was about the original inspiration and design of the sails. it was my understanding, just basically off of word of mouth, I have never seen this written anywhere, but that it was based off of a fossil. It's a brachiopod. It's a beach fossil, and it's called an Orthospherifer milwaukeensis, Latin for from Milwaukee, and it's stunningly similar to the design, and I didn't know if that was true or not, and I just wanted your insight.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, I do think that fossils and Jurassic sort of prehistoric creatures are part of the vocabulary of Calatrava, but you have to understand that he's something of a surrealist, so that you'll see imagery in his buildings. Like one of his famous buildings in Spain, the kinetic element is like an eyelid that closes over a giant orb that is a massive auditorium, a planetarium, actually. So so there is this kind of surreal connection of imagery, but I don't think it's anything as specific as a Milwaukee fossil. It's a nice story, but I just think it's part of his repertoire, looking at fossil skeletal structures that all kind of blur into other living things and into sails. So just all part of that sort of subconscious that comes up to the fore.
Hmm. Hmm. All right. Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Andy. What happened to his career in the U.S. when this building was constructed?
Well, the building received so much attention internationally. I mean, it garnered press all over the United States and abroad, and beyond just the normal art press. I mean, Time magazine named our building the best design of 2001, so it reached out into popular culture, and as we talked about before, that's continuing. So it just put him on a global stage as one of the really elite architects working today. Up at the level of Frank Gehry and Daniel Libeskind. So he's certainly one of the best known architects. Right now he's working on the PATH project at the World Trade Center site, which will be the subway station there, and it's under construction.
Mm. And did this open shortly after September 11th? Did I read it was in October?
It did. The opening was in October of 2001.
Mm. That must have been in people's minds too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you think back to that time, it really, you know, it was a time of great change, new millennium. But, it's a moment where I'm sure people felt like this was something that America could be proud of, Milwaukee could be proud of, sort of a victory.
Right.
Calatrava's major project in Chicago was going to be the Chicago Spire, and the down economy got the best of that, and that project's been put on hold. So though the hole is in the ground. No one is quite sure whether that building will ever come to fruition, but it was going to be one of the largest, if not the largest, residential tower in the world.
Oh.
So it was a quite exciting project, very ambitious, but like any of these things, the timing has to be right from a funding standpoint.
This is not a good time for it. This is really not a good time for it.
Well, it's been said that these kinds of projects, even for museums, may not be done again.
Really?
Museums, the last 10 to 20 years, have gone through major expansions. There might be a generation or two for this to really even come up again. And it's been questioned whether or not these grand buildings, which many museums lacked, by the way, over their history of evolution, smaller, more modest kinds of additions, but lacking that great architecture statement, many museums did go that route. Frank Gehry and Bilbao, for example, transformed that entire community. But the question that's out there is whether or not it will take a few more generations for these kinds of grand ideas around expansion to come up again. So our building may be unique as we move forward in time.
The flip side of that is that people look at our building and the success it's had in this community and in establishing the museum nationally and abroad, and people want that. So it'll be interesting to see if cities will want to continue to build signature architecture at this level, or if they will, in fact, have to wait.
Yeah. Well, there are key things that have to come together at a moment in time. There has to be the need. There has to be the desire on the part of the leadership of the organization to do something that is truly unique for a community. And then there has to be the financial wherewithal to pull it all together. So if those three things don't line up, There are lots of examples of, underfunded, badly designed projects, projects that maybe were too ambitious. So it's a unique alignment mm-hmm. That must come into place.
Yeah. Linda in Mequon. Hi, Linda.
Oh, hi. I am certainly a fan of the building. However, when I look at it, I see two buildings. I see the one from the past, which I grew up with, and then I see this other beautiful building. Are there any plans for the future to try to make those two buildings a unit as one? Because it looks a little bit awkward to me.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And actually, in general, when architects build additions, they have two choices. They can go with context, which is try to build something that blends in with the current site, or they can do something that is very independent. And Calatrava made an independent statement. Where the buildings do link, though, if you're walking in front of the Calatrava building towards the Saarinen and Kaler buildings, you'll see that the pathway is rusticated granite, and it ties in directly with the rusticated granite of the Saarinen building, and it's a very clear connecting point. But architecturally, the main white component of the Quadracci Pavilion is a separate statement. So that's an exterior view. The key part for us is the interior, because you go into Quadracci Pavilion, it's such an exceptional experience that our older buildings, the Saarinen and Kaler buildings, are looking a little old by comparison. So now we're working on plans to rejuvenate the collection galleries.
Hmm. Anything else, Linda?
No.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the wonderful exhibit in, well, the whole building a masterpiece, Santiago Calatrava and the Milwaukee Art Museum, which is there now, and it will continue until January 1st, 2012. Go to mam.org to get information, because you always, I assume with this too, you always have wonderful lectures and other things going on in addition to the exhibit.
We do. In fact, Paul Goldberger, who's one of the leading architectural critics in the United States, is going to be talking about Calatrava and the Quadracci Pavilion this November, so check out the website for that. And also, there is a kind of living component to this exhibition. Because there's so much interest in the building, we always see people photographing our building inside and out.
Yes.
They're shooting their friends, their family. People are taking artistic shots of the building. So we have a photo contest, and your photographs can be in the exhibition. We have large video screens with changing images of photographs submitted by people who can go to our website, submit them via Flickr. It's very easy to do, and we actually have prizes too for the best photographs.
Nice.
And we've got an app for that. So if you've always wanted to flap the wings, you can now go to iTunes and download the Milwaukee Art Museum Calatrava application, and you can literally move a little slide bar, and the wings will open and close. And there's all sorts of fun learning experiences for kids as well. It's something that we've just produced and put online.
Oh, this modern world.
This modern world.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. Also, you can go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and reply to the thread about the Milwaukee Art Museum for a chance to win a pair of free passes, good until January 1st, 2012. Particularly encouraging those of you who have never seen this building to come to Milwaukee and enjoy it. It will be, I kid you not, I guarantee it will be a wonderful experience for you. Our guests in studio in Milwaukee, Daniel Keegan, director of the Milwaukee Art Museum, Brady Roberts, chief curator. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking with an astronaut. Al Warden will join us. Al was command module pilot for the Apollo 15 mission to the moon in 1971, flying on what's widely regarded as the greatest exploration mission ever attempted. Do you look at, every time I look at the moon, I think, you know, people walked on that? I think about that every single time I see the moon. It was quite a thing. So he'll be with us tomorrow. You don't get to talk to many people who've been to the moon. So he'll be with us tomorrow. Let's go to Mary in Michigan. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I was was wondering where in Spain Calatrava is from. He sounds like he must have been from Barcelona.
He was born near Valencia.
Okay, because when I hear surrealism, I think about, well, Gaudí and Dalí and so forth.
Absolutely, and he was inspired by Gaudí, and it's my own kind of feeling that coming from the land of Dalí, that was an influence too.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. I know you have an impressionist. You've had great exhibits at the Art Museum. The Frank Lloyd Wright exhibit was marvelous. The China exhibit was gorgeous. And you have an impressionist. I know we're going to talk about this in the coming weeks, but there is an impressionist exhibit coming. Is it easier to get these exhibits to come here because of the place in which they will be housed?
Well, you know, the Quadracci Pavilion has really put us on the map internationally, and we did have a reputation. The collections are world class, and you know, many people in the field know that, but this has really launched us to a different and new level. For instance, our attendance has basically doubled since we've opened the building. We went from about 150,000 to 300,000 in fact, the past fiscal year, we had 370,000 visitors to the museum. So it's just extraordinary. And now we're able to partner regularly with institutions in the U.S. and abroad, major institutions. For instance, the Albertine is our partner with the Impressionism exhibition. Of course, we worked with the Palace Museum in China for the Forbidden City. And we continue to talk to museums all over the world about projects for the future.
Mm. You just needed to have the Brewers Rally at the Art Museum last week, and then you would have had more people coming, right?
Well, and you know, we have a lot of people from out of town who come to the museum. They're here for the sports events, but they come down to the lakefront, fabulous lakefront experiences, and the Milwaukee Art Museum, and, you know, nothing could be finer as you're waiting for a game to start or for game day itself.
Right. Yeah, how true. How true. Marie in Viroqua. Hi, Marie.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, we grew up in Milwaukee and actually roller skated at the Lincoln Memorial Drive there where the wonderful statue of Lincoln is. Mm. But we came back years and years later to see this wonderful building. And the first time I saw it, it was like something out of Peter Pan. Honest to God, it was like a swan coming out of the sky.
Mm.
Just was so impressive. I just loved it.
Mm.
So anyway, more power to you. It's a beautiful place.
Well,
thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the call. That's an analogy I hadn't heard, Brady. You're going to have to put that on your list.
That's a Peter Pan moment. You know, it's interesting. When I was working in the Southwest when the Milwaukee Art Museum addition was being built, and I knew it from photographs, but when I came to Milwaukee to see it for the first time, I really thought it was like an apparition. So I had a you know, a very similar experience. Mm. It's really unlike any other building you've seen.
Mm-hmm. My wife and I bought our 25th wedding anniversary toaster from the museum store. And that was a number of years ago, but we were there checking out the new architecture. I think it was within a couple years after it had opened. It was on our bucket list as well, and we could not believe it. And so we had to have something that would commemorate that. I had no idea I would end up back in Milwaukee directing the museum, but I'm happy to say we still have the toaster, and it still works, and it's on our counter every morning for our toast.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Marie. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, I have just a humorous episode to relate about the grand opening. I worked on setting up the lights and the sound for that event.
Oh,
and the lighting director I work with, a local guy here in Milwaukee, he was quite frustrated that he could only use white light on the building during the grand opening event because we thought, you know, how fantastic a building, and if you could slowly change colors throughout the ceremony or whatever, it would be quite stunning. But he had his hands tied behind his back. So all he could do was move the lights around, and they were these giant 7,000-watt lights. They were some of the biggest lights I think I'd ever set up in my life. And that was just kind of humorous. And also the sound department had wireless microphones that day, and there was crosstalk with a local wedding party during the opening ceremony. So it was quite humorous and at the same time kind of frantic for the sound guys. But that's just a little inside from what happened at the grand opening.
Well, those are both interesting stories, and I especially love the story about the wedding party because, you know, the Art Museum still is one of the most popular venues for weddings. Last year we did a record number of weddings at the museum, and even if young couples aren't having their wedding there, they'll come by and have their photographs taken in front of the museum. The white light observation is an interesting one because we, of course, know that Calatrava is a big fan of white. And we, though, since have experimented with colored lights. The recent Race for the Cure, a couple of years ago we had the building pink. And we've been experimenting most recently with the computer-generated LED systems now that are available because on our wish list is to get the funding to do the outside lighting of the building in a permanent way so that we can control the quality of the light, the color of the light, etc. So that's definitely on our list for things to take care of.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. I'm so glad that building is here, aren't you? I'm just so glad.
Absolutely.
Such a good thing. The building a masterpiece, Santiago Calatrava and the Milwaukee Art Museum. The exhibit runs through January 1st of 2012. We thank Daniel Keegan, director of the Milwaukee Art Museum, Brady Roberts, both of them for being with us in our studio. And do go to their website to find out about the lecture that's coming up and to see pictures. MAM.org is the place. Go to our Facebook page and you could have a chance to win a pair of passes good until January 1st, 2012. That is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Have a great week. It's going to be a great week. We got baseball, arts. It's good. Be with you again tomorrow.